This podcast is brought to you by On Track Studio.
This podcast addresses various mental health challenges, including topics such as suicide, addiction, eating disorders, depression, and anxiety. These discussions may be triggering for some individuals. If you or someone you know is struggling, please seek support from a mental health professional or a trusted individual in your life. Remember, you are not alone and help is available. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome back to Mind Your Head. This week, joining me in the studio is Jonathan Clark. Jonathan has spent the last 15 years as an infantry officer in the Australian Defence Force and now is a director at 8th Mile Consulting. Jonathan is an expert listener who understands people. He thrives in facilitating, networking and guiding individuals and organisations to succeed and build on their performance. Let's get it. Welcome to Mind Your Head, Jono.
Thanks, mate. It's good to be here.
Yeah, really, really fortunate to have you on the podcast today. There's a lot of things that I want to pick your brain about, your childhood, your military experience and the work you're doing now with 8 Mile Consulting. But firstly, I would love to get an insight into your upbringing in childhood that helped you put you on this direction in life.
I'd love to talk about the childhood, but can we quickly just talk about how we met?
Oh, yeah, we can do that.
So, Simcat, if you're listening.
Shout out, Simo.
Thanks, mate. Is my barber. And yeah, I use barber, a lot of respect for barbers, as we spoke about before the show. They act like pseudo-counsellors. And I was in there with Sim, and he's doing his thing, working his magic. He's like Edward Scissorhands, and he's doing his thing. And I'm talking. I didn't realise I'd just been talking nonstop for about 15 minutes. And he taps me on the shoulder and goes, that was pretty deep, mate. And I was like, what do you mean? I was just talking about stuff. And he goes, I've got a mate of mine I need to introduce you to. So, okay, what does he do? He goes, podcast. I was like, oh, great. What have I said in the last 15 minutes?
Because you know what he said to me? He goes, get him on American Sniper vibes. I'm like, really? He's like, yep.
Just without the confidence of Chris Kyle. That guy's an animal.
There's a weapon, yeah.
So childhood-wise, it'll be usually when I tell people where I'm from, they instantly reach for their back pocket to make sure their wallet's still there. So I was born in Adelaide. Yes. All right, but in Elizabeth.
Okay.
All right. Now, Elizabeth had, I think, the highest crime rate for aggravated assault, cars, high intensity stuff for about 30 years. And the difference about people from Elizabeth is they're proud of it. Okay. All right. Yeah. So I lived there probably about 9 years. My mum and my dad are both ex-Air Force. Didn't really register for me from a military service perspective because by the time I came around, they were out. Mm. My dad worked in avionics. Mum was a paralegal. My parents split, and then I moved with my mum and sister up to the Gold Coast, and then that's where I grew up. Dad followed probably about a year later. And then on the Gold Coast, mate, the Gold Coast life is the Gold Coast life. Mm. You know, it's like we've got one personality you show to everyone, and then your real personality, and that's, if you're ever dating someone on the Gold Coast, that's ground for breaking up. You'd be like, I actually got to know you in that. Yeah, okay, fair play.
It'd be a lot different to Adelaide too, wouldn't it?
Right? The beach and the weather and a bit more humid.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we did the Gold Coast thing, went to school there, started playing rugby, which was a bit of a difference from AFL, but also being in that school environment seemed like the right thing to do. And getting hit a bit different, I kind of enjoyed that. So that was okay.
Yeah.
Joined the military when I was 17.
Yeah, wow.
All right, so fresh out of school, as soon as I could, I was like, all right, well, what are your options? And I couldn't think of anything worse than studying longer. And I was getting into a fair bit of trouble outside of things, like, starting to get noticed for all the wrong things. Mm. And so I was like, well, here's your choice. Mm. You can either go do some B-grade NAF university degree that would mean nothing to you moving forward, or you do something better. And now my dad always wanted me to be an Air Force officer. Didn't have the eyes for it. Didn't really appeal to me. Blue, not for me.
Yeah.
So I decided to go the complete opposite and join as an Army soldier.
Yeah.
So I joined as a soldier first. I did 4 years in an infantry battalion in Townsville at the 1st Battalion, and then crossed over to become an officer at the end of 2005. I went through the Australian Defence Force Academy, which is like your military university.
Yeah.
Plus they do a lot of military training, leadership, all your basic skills. And then you go over to the Royal Military College for a year to do your Army-specific officer training.
Yeah.
Graduated from there in 2009. 2010 was posted to the 8th, 9th Battalion as a infantry platoon commander. You go through your suite of infantry officer courses, range qualifications, you name it, and then went into this period of courses, field, courses, field, courses, field, and that tempo stayed pretty high all the way through 10, 11, deployed to Afghanistan at January 2012, came back in July, moved through the rest of my time there, and then was promoted, took over as a company second in command for 2 years, then went to the School of Languages to learn Farsi and Dari.
Oh, did you?
Another year, because I thought, I wanted to go back overseas. It's going to help. So if I can speak the language, that'll be good.
Yeah.
Didn't end up going back. Went to an organisation called Headquarters 1st Division in Brisbane. And then that's where the body started to fall apart.
Play up a little bit, yeah.
And then I got the tap on the shoulder by the doc that goes, hey, mate, if you keep going the way you're going, you're not going to be able to kick a football in 2 years.
Yeah.
And I have some issues with not being able to kick a football because I saw what happened with my dad after his stroke, you know, not being able to kick a footy. That really upset him and just straight through the fields. And they went, hey, look, you either core transfer and you go to ordnance or transport or something, or you get out. And I'm like, well, I'm an infantryman, always have been, always will be. If it's not that, then it's nothing.
Nothing, yeah.
Left on a Friday, started in aged care, not-for-profit, IT projects, which makes absolutely no sense in that transition period.
Yeah.
In Brisbane, with my best mate, we both end up as project leads on the same project, finished that contract and then started 8th Mile, which is where we are now.
So we're going to go back.
Yeah, mate, I just thought I'd give you give you the scope and then we can dig in wherever you want.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of the questions was what motivated you to get into the army. Mm-hmm. You explained that. And then 4 years as an infantry soldier. What motivated you to be an officer after that?
That's a really interesting question. So it's funny because what you're probably going to see throughout this is I've never really been motivated by rewards.
Yeah, okay.
It's more fear-based, all right? So like fear pushing you forward. And I can talk into now I know why those systems work, which I didn't know at the time, is if I had stayed the way I was going prior to joining the military, I probably would have ended up somewhere like jail, right? So I was like, well, I don't want to do that. Well, what can you do? That's not that. Join the military and less trouble, more discipline. Yeah, fine. Yeah. Do that. And so as we go through, that's sort of pushing. When I was in the infantry battalion, I had a platoon commander. I'm not going to mention his name, but we were having a chat once and I went, stupid, right? You make the call and then you regret it instantly, but it sort of worked. I went, you know what? I could do what you're doing.
Oh, no.
But I mean, it worked out, right?
Yeah.
And he goes, well, do it.
Yeah.
And I went, what? He goes, well, do it. In my head, I'm like, but I don't want to. Yeah. you know, he goes, do it.
Yeah.
And I went, what do you mean? And he goes, mate, I'll sign the paperwork. I'll get it recommended through. I'll do it. And now I'm caught.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, I've got to double down. So I did. I doubled down and went through. And I had a choice between, you know, you either go through Royal Military College straight away and then get straight back into it, or you go Australian Defence Force Academy. And I had some officers at the time that I really, really respected. I had a chat with them and they were like, hey, take the hit now in the 3 years. Go and get the degree. It'll set you up in good stead later.
Mm.
I was like, I hadn't studied since leaving school. So that was a nightmare.
And I was terrible at school, so studying was...
I just hated it. Yeah. I was just no good.
Yeah.
And so when I got to ADFA, I had to relearn how to write essays. So when all my mates were out drinking, I'm at this thing called the ALL unit, which is teaching you how to write essays in my first year. So it was a grind.
Yeah.
But you know, you pick it up. So it was more fear of turning around to that platoon commander, the officer, and going, well, actually, I've been a little bitch,
right? Yeah.
There's fear of being a little bitch
that
led me to go, okay, well, fine, we'll do this thing and we'll take it to its logical conclusion.
So you mentioned the transition sort of from Gold Coast and then into the military life. What shocked you the most about enlisting?
Oh, I'm just going to say the thing. All right. So when I enlisted day one, right, so Gold Coast. So you can imagine, I'm fresh off schoolies.
Yeah, same.
Right?
Yeah, just finished schoolies. 1 month later, I'm getting a bus down to Wagga Wagga. And I'm like, what the fuck am I doing?
I guarantee you didn't look like I did.
Okay.
Right? So I was like, bleach blonde hair, like baggy polo, baggy jeans. Because I don't know what to expect. And as soon as I walked in to do the sign-on and the stand and all that, they just looked at me. I was like, oh, this is going to cost me in a big way. So, you know, you get on the bus, everyone's happy, everything's jovial until you get about an hour out from Wagga. Mm. And then the mood just gets real dark real quick.
It does.
And then you get off the bus and it's carnage, right? People are screaming, yelling, pushing people around. And I'm realizing that you got to carry everything in your left arm. And I've got the heaviest suitcase in the world, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm weighing 63 kilos.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, it was about me too, actually. Yeah.
I did not think this through in any great level of detail. And I turned around because I was like, that's carnage. And I turn around and then I just get shunted off the bus because I'm getting back on the bus. This is rubbish. Turn around, just get shunted off the bus. And here we go. And then straight away they see the bleach blonde hair and they're just
already India.
And I just get fed.
Yeah.
And I remember after like just getting almost like sensory overload, going, I have no idea why I'm here, why I'm doing this. This is just rubbish. What am I doing? Mm. And then I turn around, look back at the bus, and this guy gets off with a mohawk. And I'm like, oh, thank God.
Next target.
I'm not the heat. I know that. Yeah. And his is right down to skin.
Oh, wow.
Too. So even if he goes number one, you're still going to see a bit of the mohawk, whereas mine's grown out, right? Yeah. So when I shave my head, I'm going to have normal hair.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was the that was like day one.
Mm.
And that's just where we kicked off.
Yeah.
And, mate.
Wagga wasn't too bad, but when I went to Singleton, something that really like struck with me that I still remember is when they show operations overseas, it's sort of like, I guess their way of desensitizing you to what you're going to be seeing overseas. Mm-hmm. And I played competitive sports, mainly rugby, my whole life. And I remember sitting in the auditorium and they were showing us like, you know, head cam footage of shit going on overseas. And I was just, I remember with my best mate, we played footy together all our lives. And I remember sitting next to him, and we both thought like winning and losing on a footy field, you might be a bit sore, whatever, but there's always next week and you play again next week. But we took out of that, like if you lose in combat or over in deployment or, you know, more often than not, you might not be coming home. And we're 17 years old, like you. And we're like, fuck, like we're in the man's world now. Like, we're in some heavy shit now. And that took a lot of, like, getting used to. And even, like, when we did military self-defense, like, some of the tactics that they were telling us to use, if you ever got in a situation where you had to fist fight with the enemy, like, he was giving us, like, I was like, fuck, that's brutal. And he's just like, we're not here to fucking fight fair. Like,
I think his comment would have been, we're not here to fuck spiders.
Yeah, yeah. And he's like, we're here to fucking win, like... So that was like a big...
So what year was that? What year did you go?
So I went in 2008.
Yeah. So you would have had all the footage. I went through in 02.
Oh, so it would have been your footage.
Didn't have... No, not my footage.
Yeah, yeah.
But they didn't have a lot of that
Heaps footage of it. Yet. Yeah, yeah.
So there wasn't a lot of it back then because, you know, 2001. Mm. Yeah, I think everyone can remember where they were.
Absolutely.
September 11.
Absolutely.
I was in a gym on a rower. I looked up and like, this movie looks cool. And I was like... Well, that's not the movie.
To make you feel old, I was in grade 7.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And my dad got me out of bed. He was like, you've got to watch this.
Yeah, yeah.
And I still remember him like, you've got to remember this.
And I remember going, once I realised it wasn't a movie, I mean, how naive.
Mm.
And once I realised it wasn't a movie, I was like, all right, that's heavy. Mm. And it's probably the first time I think I'd felt that kind of, you know, rage.
Yeah.
And it's almost like that, how dare you?
Mm.
I was like, okay, all right. Well, that's where we're headed. Let's do it. I was already in the process. I was like, okay, so now there's more of a purpose to it. Yeah.
So
okay.
Were you already in the military at that point?
No. No, just I was like towards the end of school. I was thinking about schoolies.
Yeah, yeah, right.
You know, training up for schoolies.
Yeah, yeah. Different sort of training.
Gold Coast training, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So was that part of the motivation, I guess, when you saw that? Were you like...
Well, not initially.
Not initially, yeah.
But then you go... Okay, that's what we're aiming for. There's got to be some payback. And then you go, okay, well, that's just another layer on top of it where, you know, I'm talking about being fear-based.
Mm.
Also, like the fear of something like that happening again pushes you to go do a thing. Now, I wouldn't deploy overseas in operations until 2012. I'd already done a lot of time in the military while I was... In training for ADFA and RMC, my battalion deployed twice.
Yep.
So you're sitting there watching your mates go over there, you're seeing a few of your mates not come back, and you go, okay, all right. It just add more.
Fuel to the fire there.
I was living in the times where some of the greatest soldiers ever are going through. You know? And you're talking about complex warfare, and some of the things that those guys were doing over there are just superhuman.
Yeah.
And you never have enough respect for guys like that.
So you went to officer school, and I'm really interested to know the love of leadership. Did you find it at officer school? Is that where you all had a keen interest to lead, I guess? Because as an infantry soldier, you're being led.
Well, where I was lucky is moving through an infantry battalion, I saw some amazing leaders. I mean, these are still people I could quote off the top of my head. And, you know, a lot of them were corporals. When you're actually going through, especially with the history of being an infantry soldier, you go through with this idea of what good officers, good sergeants, good corporals and that look like. And it actually has the reverse effect. It's like, I know what to aim at, but there is absolutely no way I'm ever going to reach that.
That standard's so high.
It's like, come on.
Yeah.
You're never going to be that fit, that strong, that smart, make decisions that quick. And you're going, I don't care how much training you do. Like, what is that?
Yeah.
You know? But then, you know, the system prepares you to a point to be able to take that on. So I went through with a lot of imposter syndrome. The soldier skills, okay.
Yeah.
Fine. But also knowing the high standards of junior leaders within the military, like that can be intimidating. And then your peers and people that I went through at for an RMC with, you're like, natural. Like these guys don't have to work and they're just going to smash it. So you go through both getting pushed by this imposter syndrome, but also chasing what good looks like.
Yeah.
So I think I was lucky in the cohort I went through and the experience I had to have the benefit of really good leaders around me. As for developing the love of leadership, again, I felt like it was more getting pushed through rather than rewards. Like, oh, that's what good leadership is. It's like, no, that's what bad looks like.
Yeah.
Don't be that. Go just stay in it and don't be that. And then if you're going to aim at that, it's okay, aim at that if you can. But that was infinitely more scary because you'd seen what bad looks like. You know, I don't want to be that. So I don't know if it was ever love of leadership rather than a fear of letting people down.
And there's different kinds of leaders, isn't there? What are the different kinds of leaders that you saw?
Oh, mate, now that I've been in the leadership game for a little while, you can sort of break it down to the theoretical knowledge of it. But it's, you know, you could go through authoritarian, democratic, collaborative, empathetic, coaching, mentor. I could go through all of that, but really it doesn't make any sense. You go into good, bad, average.
Yeah, right.
You know, and those good, really good leaders will change their style based on their team. So one minute they'll be very authoritarian, especially in a crisis. But this is the decision. This is how we're going. This is how we're going to make it. Where there's no time, decision needs to be made. And then within, you know, a few minutes, when there's a tactical pause or there's time, they'll be like, all right, guys, bring it in. I need information on this. And then they'll collaborate to make a decision.
So you got to have each quality of a leader and make it your own.
Yep. Yeah. So it's almost, and, you know, people will rail against this idea, as we've seen in what we do. It's this idea of wearing a mask. You know, you see it on the back of my T-shirt. It says, leadership is not about you. And I didn't grasp that until much later. But the best officers that I'd ever seen, the best corporals, the best sergeants, always adjusted their style to suit what the team needed.
Yeah.
And that takes some guts because there's this stereotype officer that people see in the movies, or there's a stereotype officer that people want, they think they want. But it's this ability to transition between different styles that separated good from great, from excellent. And bad was almost like, I have one style. You will all adapt to me.
It's like that yelling that everyone sees on TV or movies of the army, of just that guy just yelling, that drill instructor just yelling at you.
And it's like, that's all they've got, though.
Yeah,
I mean,
those
leaders are the ones that's like, well, I've got one tool, and that one tool is yelling. And at one stage, or at some stage, it loses its effect.
Yeah. It would, absolutely.
I had a sergeant at ADFA who that was him.
Yeah.
He was disciplined. You know, he'd come into people's rooms, throw their stuff all over the place, really rule by fear. And then it got to a point, it would have been a couple of months in, where everyone was like, you see their eyes glaze over whenever he walks up, and they just go, I know what you're going to do.
Yeah.
You're predictable to the point of being irrelevant. Oh, you're going to yell at me. Okay, you're going to put me on the drill square. Well, if I'm going to be on the drill square anyway, what else have you got? And you see them, they just blank. And then you go, these are the future leaders of the military, and this one sergeant is significantly undermining that relationship. It wasn't reflective of senior NCOs that I knew. So all the other senior NCOs that we had through training were, oh, it's quality. Amazing.
Mm.
And they're the, you want officers to be paired up with them because the quality of the senior NCO will mentor a good officer. I've been so lucky. I had amazing sergeants throughout my history.
Yeah.
And they were mentors. Never threw you under the bus. They guided you. They mentored you. And, you know, they were like, it's almost like they could see the bigger picture. Mm. So a sergeant would adjust their style to you. In front of the lads, they would be a certain way.
Mm.
Behind closed doors, they'd be a certain way. So you always felt like you could trust them. And if you could trust them, you could go, oi.
You follow them.
I'm not confident right now. This is where I'm at. And they go, okay, well, this, boom, 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 boom. And then when you got in front of the lads, you were this united front. It's like, let's do this. Let's go. The best leaders, and I think the good leadership, are those that can adjust their style and their approach based on what the team needed.
Mm.
I've always seen those to be the best. You know, it's not just one way. They can switch and adjust and morph into what they need to be for their teams, and that's hard.
It's hard to do, yeah.
It's like parenting, right? Good leadership is hard. Yeah. Good parenting is hard. If it's not hard, if it's easy, you're missing something.
Something that I'm really interested in is obviously being an officer in the military. Is a position that I noticed when I was in there that you're constantly being judged or critiqued nonstop. And obviously the soldiers look to you for command. And how did you handle those responsibilities or the high-pressure situations? And how did your approach to that change over time?
Well, you get used to this constant assessment. All right, so you're getting assessed by your teams, you're getting assessed by your peers, and you're getting assessed by your superiors all the time. It's this constant norm. It's like being afraid or having that, not fight, flight, freeze in the traditional sense, but it's just like this gut churn of assessment all the time. So it's almost like desensitized for a little bit, but then part of you is sitting there going, now you're being tested all the time. Well, you got to show up.
Mm.
If you're going to be tested, then let's see where you're actually at in the testing. So you step willingly forward into being tested. So it's okay, I'm in front of the lads, I'm being tested. They're looking for gaps, they're looking for weaknesses, they're looking for all this. So you don't drop the guard. You know, they talk about authentic leadership.
Yeah.
I don't know what that is. It doesn't make any sense to me. Because some of the times when you're, especially in some of the more hairy situations, if you were authentic and vulnerable in what you're feeling, you're not going to inspire any faith in anyone ever.
Yeah.
All right? So going, oh, shit, 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 shit. But if you demonstrate that,
here.
Right? It's like, yeah. Oh, I didn't really plan for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, I know what you mean.
But
yeah.
if you were to show that, then you lose the confidence of your team.
Yeah, yeah.
And so with this whole idea of being assessed at all levels all the time and how to deal with it, again, a common thread, mate, fear. Fear-based. The fear of letting people down is enough to push you through to do the things that need to be done. And, you know, you end up working outrageous hours, outrageous times, but it's like that fear of letting people down pushes you forward. Now, if you can orientate that towards our goal or something, then you get, and we talk about the, now I know what it is, the science and the data about competing systems where, you know, fear is adrenaline cortisol pushing you forward. A motivation or a goal is dopaminergically moderated.
Yeah.
And they don't overlap. They work in sequence.
Yeah.
So it's like, if I'm going to be running from something, I'm running at that. So you end up retaining your faculties a lot longer. Whereas if you were to just subscribe to a fear-based thing,
yeah.
Fight, flight, freeze, you lose your ability to think and analyze and make decisions. So
yeah.
I think the way I've always seen being able to manage that level of stress is that fear of letting people down was strong enough to push you forward into doing things that are uncomfortable and then get comfortable being uncomfortable because it's an environmental norm. You can't run from it.
Do you thrive in high-pressure situations?
I don't think it came naturally, but I come from a school of thought where I think crisis leadership or chaotic leadership is slightly easier, and it's a seductive lure if you're not careful, because what happens in crisis, there's a problem. And people go, I just want the problem to stop. They don't care about interpersonal relationships. They don't care about frictions. They don't care about who took the last, you know, donut from the Bay Marie. They don't care about that. They just want the problem to stop. Where you start to find problems and where I think it's infinitely harder is when there is no burning platform. Like, you know, people in the military nowadays, there's not. I mean, yeah, we've got Ukraine, Russia, we've got a lot of conflict in the world. Preparation for conflict might be there, but the whole time in my service, we had Afghanistan, we had Iraq, we had some other conflict that was going on. So people always had something to aim at.
Well, that was driving you forward because you knew you had to.
Yeah.
But nowadays, or now at the moment, there's nothing.
I mean, I'm not privy to a lot of information that's kicking around the military.
Yeah, but, yeah.
You know, soldiers were aligned to operations.
Yeah.
That's where we're always geared to. Mm. All the training was geared and operation. It was always had an operational focus because you knew you're going over there. So a lot of the noise filters away because you've got an operational focus. Crisis leadership was a learned, or chaotic leadership was a learned thing for me. I don't think I was natural at it at all. But being able to build the processes, systems in there to be able to make decisions. And also I was mentored and guided by some guys that were amazing in crisis. So you go, okay, well, now I know what good looks like. Aim at that. Like, do that. Whatever that is, do that.
Do the same.
Yeah, but maybe not to the same level that they could. I mean, I'll tell you about one of my platoon sergeants. His name's Simon Jones. Sorry, mate. You know I love you. All right, this guy's a weapon in crisis. He's unflappable.
Yeah.
In crisis, both in training and, you know, he's on a podcast and I heard about some of his other operational stuff and he just gets it and he was natural and just, he had this way of, I mean, I don't know what was going on in his brain, he could have been freaking out, right? But he just had this mask.
Just stay calm.
Pulling a knight's visor down and everyone would just draw a lot of comfort from him because he could just make a decision, he'd just get it done. I remember once we were on exercise and we're on a bit of a rotation where it was like not a lot of sleep. And there's this point in time, if you have a power nap, where anything over like 22 minutes, you space out and you're just like dizzy and all that. And in this training exercise, got hit and I was at my 21-minute mark. And I woke up and I just could not get myself back under. And he comes up and he grabs me and goes, "Oh, JC." And I was just like cross-eyed doing all sorts of stuff. And he goes, "I'll give you a minute." And he just goes and just starts running it.
Oh, right? Wow.
And then I finally got my stuff together. He came back, gives me his beautiful handover and then just on, and everything just was seamless after that. And he just always seemed to have an answer. I caught up with him when I was on deployment over in Afghanistan, and he just has this way of, if you're working with him, he just calms you down. So you look at it and you go, that's a mentor. And he would mentor his junior people well, he'd mentor senior people. There's no arrogance, there's no us against them, no senior NCOs versus officers, nothing. It's just like, if you're in the team, you're in the team. If you're in attachment, you're in the team. And I was like, okay, so that's what good looks like. Mm. Right. And as a man, as a family man, like loves his daughter. He's just had a new baby girl and he's committed to his kids. And you just go, that is an example that you can take to the bank all day. Let's do this. So my career was littered with people like that. You know, and same with guys like my best mate, who's also my business partner. You want to talk about critical analysis under pressure, that guy.
Really?
Mate, I don't care who you are. You see that and you just go, well, that's something to chase. Now, I'm not competing against him. I'm always competing with him. But it's like, all right, that's what good looks like. All right, let's dig.
Yeah.
I hate studying. I hate reading, all of that sort of stuff. I like reading, but not the stuff that we have to read.
Yeah.
But I'm like, I've got to keep up. So it's always good to have something to chase.
And you mentioned, like, you had so many great mentors. How did you develop your identity as an officer and make it your own style?
Initially, I just had this list of what not to do.
Yeah.
And that seemed to get you by.
Get me
into the game.
Yeah.
And then you start going, okay, I remember when I was in this situation, I saw this and that one. Good. See, I've got a bit more of a familiar, not too familiar, but more of a familiar mechanism, say, as a platoon commander, is to play rugby with the lads. I was always down with them doing training and all that. So I was a lot closer, try and know their families, kids, so that you knew them. So I was a lot closer. Some officers preferred to maintain this chasm of difference. And that worked for them.
Yeah,
it worked for their style and all that. So I think once I actually started to be tested, you had to find a way that worked for you.
Mm.
And, you know, same. You would adapt and shift and change styles. I don't think I've got any singular style. It's more of an adapting and morphing style to whatever the situation needs at the time. I am very extroverted. I like being around teams and people that I know. But I also, if you need to play the introvert and shut up and listen, you can do that as well. But, I mean, you only learn that from experience hindsight. And let's be honest, completely fucking it up.
Trial and error, isn't it?
Right? Yeah, and, you know, you learn more from your mistakes and your successes. And that's I've had a lot of mistakes to learn from. So
you deployed overseas in 2012.
Yep.
Just for the people listening, who's under your command when you go overseas?
So at that stage, I deployed as a what they call a tactical Overwatch platoon commander. Yep. So and depending on the mission scenario, we were very dislocated in my teams. We got split all over the place and anywhere between 30 to 42 soldiers, depending on the mission, including vehicles, drivers, crew command. Mate, I had an absolute weapon of a motorized crew commander. Russ was, you know, he's like 21, 22, and this guy's living, you know, 10 years older than he should be. And again, critical thinking, able to keep vehicles running, make decisions without supervision. These guys were just fantastic. I also deployed with the majority of what we call the reconnaissance platoon, and the smart, fit, strong. One of my corporals was also someone I was a soldier with. Back in the battalion, people were like, oh, are you going to be able to do that? It's like, that's one of the most professional guys around. Like, this is going to be fine.
Yeah.
My boss at the time was also someone who had been one of my platoon commanders when I was a soldier. So I suppose, you know, anywhere between 35 and 42 soldiers, but then depending on the mission, you could have up to 120, 200 people and then include the Afghan National Army guys. Now, our mission when we got over there was more mentoring.
Yeah.
So training the Afghan National Army guys to be able to take the fight to the Taliban when we left. We were also sandbagged between two of the biggest green on blue scenarios that had happened in Afghanistan. So the patrol base that we took over from had the Afghan officer that walked out in the playground and killed three Australian soldiers and wounded a few more. The platoon commander I handed over to up at a patrol base, one of the mobile patrol bases that we worked out of, he lost three soldiers to an Afghan person coming out and killing three of them as well. So it was more of an insider threat for us.
I went to Kapuka with one of the guys.
It's hard, man.
I room with him.
Yeah, mate, it's
couldn't believe it.
Mate, it's hard because, you know, say when Dave went, so my business partner, best mate, when he went over there with his trip, his was all, this is a line in the sand. Taliban owns that. We own this. Move that line. Right? So it was fight, fight, fight. Some of the biggest threats that I had were waiting, shot in the back. Like that was the that was the thing. And it was literally one of my mates who was the platoon commander for the team that we took over from. He just lost three of his soldiers to an insider threat. And then the guy handed over to him. I was just like, fuck me. Better lucky than good sometimes, you know.
What was a defining moment or moments overseas on your deployment that shaped you as a leader?
I think potentially one of my big mistakes that I made that has definitely informed how we run our consulting side of the house or how we run leadership training. And that's a failure to empathize with both the Afghan National Army guys that we were training to the degree that we probably needed to. I mean, we made it work, right? So we didn't have any fatalities or significant casualties, which is good. So it's really hard to regret anything that happened over there. I don't think I empathized with my boss very well.
Okay.
And I think that mistake has really led me to question and develop and understand more about how to empathize with people at all levels. Because, you know, it's really easy to sit there and go, ivory tower, what would they know? They're not on the ground with me at the moment. They don't know the situation.
They're not seeing what I'm seeing. Yeah.
But then you sit there and you go, well, I'm not seeing what they're seeing either.
Mm.
And it's really easy to vilify your commanders if you don't know what they're going through at the time. So, you know, he's getting smashed, competing priorities for strategic level stuff. And I'm sitting here going, you know, we're just trying to go out and do these. Mm. And I think what ended up happening is I became pretty difficult to work with for him while I was over there. I think my soldiers paid the price because, you know, he would go around me and just directly to the soldiers because I don't think he trusted me, didn't trust my judgment. It happened on the last patrol that I wasn't out on. So I didn't end up going out with them on the last biggest one. And that's when everything went down for my guys. Although in contact most days, they we had an Afghan National Army vehicle get ripped open and then they ambushed from three sides. And I'm sitting here in the command post going, all right, I think I did not manage this relationship effectively. I think that was one of the defining moments. I was like, John, you've pride. You've got to drop this rubbish and leave pride at the door. Ego, fine. Ego is your sense of self and where you draw a lot of strength and power to be able to do hard things. But that pride shit, it's got to go, because you're letting pride get in the way of your relationships, and it's undermining your influence and your ability to, you know, shape what's going on, all because you're being a dick.
It's like, did you turn that around quickly?
I don't think I ever really fixed the relationship with my boss at that time. We, you know, worked together in certain environments after that, but
this is a lesson.
Lessons carried forward, mate, and you know, especially when we're in our coaching. So we coach a lot of executives, and you know, they sit there and like they, them. It's like, hang on, I get it, but scratch a little bit deeper on that behavior. Where's that coming from? And you know, you tend to say, if you can't find why people are behaving in a certain way and attribute it to rewards or motivation or goals, then you've got to trace the fear. And if you trace the fear, you can genuinely find why people are behaving the way they are, and then you can protect it. Right, in that case. But at that stage, I wonder, you know, I've never really caught up with him, have a chat with it. I wonder if it was like fear of me going rogue or doing something that really impinged that relationship.
That trust.
Mate, I've got to be honest, he was one of my platoon commanders when I was a soldier. If anyone's going to build a relationship with a guy and have it really strong and reinforced, but pride got in the way, and I think I just became really difficult to work with.
What I've gathered from you just talking is that change and uncertainty is almost guaranteed. Mm-hmm. How do you navigate your way through those changes and stay adaptable?
Well, what's the alternative?
Yeah. Some people hate change. Some people, it's so hard for them to be adaptable.
Yeah, and that'll cost them. You know, you've got to toe this line between chaos and order, I suppose. You know, chaos being change, order being the structural policy or process that is stable within the environment. But if you go one way, then nothing changes and you don't end up getting better, you don't increase performance, you don't adapt to the environment because the environment is chaotic. But if you go too far in the chaos side of the house and you don't build structures and systems to support the changes you've made, then you fall flat on your face. So I think in that middle ground is this dance. Now, uncertainty is one of the biggest fears for anyone. But if you can find relevance in the chaos, so you can track where your relevance and your competence is in a chaotic environment, it removes some of that uncertainty. So, you know, you would have dealt with change. So going from a civilian environment to a military, that is a change.
Yeah.
Right. Now, people either turn around and go, oh, I got through that. Thank God. That's good. I can get through a change. Other people go, oh, well, I can adapt. I'm resilient. I can make changes. You know, they reframe it in their brain. It's not like, I just did this one thing.
So it's how you view it.
Exactly. It's like, oh, I solved this problem. It's like, no. I solved problems. I led this mission. No, you lead missions. You know, you, first time, oh, I ran one podcast. No, I run podcasts. Yeah. That's what you do.
Yeah.
Right? For people that are scared of public speaking, they get up and they speak one time. And they're like, oh, I'm so glad I got through that. It's like, well, hang on. No, you now speak in public.
Yeah.
That's what you do. You've done it. So I think it's reframed. So chaos... The chaos and the crisis and uncertainty. It's like, well, I've been through things that are uncertain. So it's not like I just got through one thing that was uncertain. It's like, well, you get through uncertain things. And there's a system, there's a process, or there's a mechanism of thinking about it. It's like, what do I know? Not what do I assume, what do I know? And then we act on things that are fact and as best we can. Sometimes you have to make assumptions in planning and strategy, and I get that. But, you know, what do I know? Because otherwise you end up spooling off, just going completely left field, and then the situation doesn't look anything like what you started. Whereas, like, if I'd have just stuck to what I knew, I would have made a better decision.
I consume a lot of content from Simon Sinek.
Yep.
I'm sure you're familiar with him. And he said two great qualities for an effective leader. He says empathy and perspective. Mm-hmm. It's not about being in charge. It's about taking care of those in our charge. Mm-hmm. I think you touched on it a little bit earlier. How do you define true leadership, and what qualities are essential for an effective leader?
Leadership's a tough one.
Because I know you're saying like different types of leaders in different situations.
Yeah.
And I think you touched on about emotional intelligence and having that empathy. What other qualities, I think?
Well, I think leadership is about service. I think Simon nailed it. Right? And I think one of the things about leadership that people don't realise when they and they start talking about it, they're like, oh, you know, corner officers and car parks and whatever. Is what we've got to understand about leadership, especially in a competency hierarchy, is this the higher you go in a leadership framework, the more lonely it is. It is categorized by lonely, and it's categorized by accountability. It's categorized by holding the risk when everything goes down and blows up. So once you understand that, you go, well, actually, let's be honest, if you're doing it right, leadership sucks.
It's funny you mention that, because Rich McCall, captain of the All Blacks, I read Dan Carter's book, and he said, to be a captain of the All Blacks, it's meant to be like this pinnacle stuff, but he was saying it's the loneliest place to be, because you're in that middle ground of like, I've got to rip into the boys, I can't be their mates too much, I've got to be sort of close to the coaches. He goes, it can be a lonely, lonely place to be.
And it's influence-based.
Yeah.
It's based on your competence and your relevance.
Yeah.
All right? And if you get that wrong, if you lose the competence part, you start losing your influence. If you lose the relevance part, you start losing your influence. So I think in essence, leadership is about, well, it's not about you. There you go. It's probably a reason why I've got it on my shirt, is leadership is not about you as the leader. It's about those people that you are tasked to lead. Now, leadership might not be positional. Now, that throws a bit of a spin in there because you see a lot of people with a lot of influence in organizations that aren't positional, but they still have a responsibility to those people.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, so I think, you know, leadership's not about you. It's about accountability. It's about service. And it's about integrity. Mm. It's about doing the thing that you promise or doing the thing that you said you were going to do and doing it the same way when people are watching as when they're not watching. And I think if you get those things right, you're going to be all right.
The ability to make tough decisions, and you touched on it earlier, not only to make tough decisions, but to make them quickly is an essential part of the skill that an officer must have. How do you make tough decisions?
I get comfortable being uncomfortable.
Can you share time in deployment where you had to make a tough decision?
The very first meeting I had with an Afghan commander. Now, knowing what we're going into, the potential for green on blue threat and all that, you know, you've got to toe this fine line.
Green on blue threat for people.
Yep. So Afghans were green forces.
Yeah.
Australians were blue.
Blue. Yeah.
An Afghan person killing Australian forces or trying to target. You know, the Taliban came up with a really effective strategy of being able to defect Afghan National Army people. And one of the difficult conversations or difficult scenarios that I was pushed into was walking into that first meeting, and you go, all right, so you know potentially someone within that force is looking to shoot you in the back, yet you've got to try and build trust. You've got to try and build camaraderie. You've got to try and build a professional relationship because you're going to be going out on patrol with these guys. Mm. You'll be mentoring them, training with them, and then trying to mitigate that and communicate that with your soldiers. Now, they get it. They get this thing called trust with insurance, you know, so someone's always ready to go. But that's probably one of the most difficult situations I was faced with because, you know, one of my mates was the platoon commander and had his very soldiers killed. And so you go in there and you're like, how do I act to this person? Well, this is probably one of those times where I actually got the empathy piece right, you know, which didn't happen very often. But he'd be looking at us knowing that one of his people has killed some of us. And you go,
what a strange dynamic this fucking thing is.
This is going to be hard for both of us.
Mm.
All right. So you go and you have that conversation. I found it very difficult to maintain that line between professionalism, you know, mission focus, purpose, and all that, with looking at them with this, you know, you killed some of us, you know, because, well, he didn't, but someone in that uniform did. And our whole mission at that stage was mental.
Mm.
And so I was railing in my brain, I was railing with this, you know, we're fighters, our job is to go out and fight, but now we're teaching, we're coaching. In order to teach and coach, we need to be empathetic and understanding of them in their situation, like walk 5 miles in someone else's shoes, insert wanky cliche, whatever you want. But bottom line is I had to empathize with this person. And
in the most difficult time as well.
And I was like, I don't like you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know what it was? It was like, in order to keep my soldiers alive, I have to build a relationship with this person.
Mm.
And that relationship has to be built on what I now know to be shared values. What were those shared values? It was things like courage, family. You know, you understand that this is their life. They go home for leave, not the other way around. It's like, we're here for 6 months and then we go home. It's like, well, they, you know, when they have leave, they go home for 6 weeks and then they come back. Their life is this patrol base. It's like, you just got to neck up, John, and you got to listen to what they're saying. Try and build a relationship, because if you build a solid relationship and, you know, you're like, we'll fight together when we go outside the wire, we'll patrol together, we'll make an impact, you know, then that's going to protect your soldier. I found that very, very difficult to come to grips with that. And I felt like a lot of the time I was on autopilot in those discussions, just like we prioritise the relationship over the incident. So when you would have arguments with them, when you fight, you'd be like, prioritise the relationship over the incident. Build the relationship.
Is that what you tell yourself?
Yep.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it was hard, mate. Yeah, it was really hard because sometimes you want to walk over there and just be like, I'm going to feed you because of that. But then you go, relationship, because that's going to keep your soldiers relatively safe.
Yeah. Safe as you can, at least.
Safe as you can in that environment. Yeah. So
we live in a society at the moment that's full of procrastination and avoidance of making hard decisions. What have you found during, especially during your work that you're doing now, why do people avoid making hard decisions?
I look at it from a perspective of consequence. I tend to find that a lot of the people that are driven, especially with self-discipline, like it's just driven, they're mainly running from something, all right? So you've got this idea between running from and running to. Running to is your goals, what you're motivated by and all that. And then you've got this running from, which is your self-discipline, which is anchored in fear. And those people with a strong enough fear are pushed to maintain their self-discipline and pushed to act in a way that would set them, their future selves, up for success. Say you don't want to train today, right? Now, I don't enjoy training because it hurts in back, knees, and it sucks. All right, I'll tell you a story, and this is what has helped me get through procrastination and helped me do difficult things that I don't want to do, including having difficult conversations. When I left the military, I went in a bit of a spiral. That was pretty bad. Drew a lot of identity from the fact that I was an infantryman or an infantry officer. Once I didn't have that, I was like, well, who the fuck am I? Like, what's the fuck am I doing? Mm. Like, that was who I am. And, you know, the fact that it wasn't a choice, it was like, fuck, where do I go from here? And I didn't have, you know, went into projects, IT, not-for-profit. And then my wife and I, we did about 11 rounds of IVF over 4 years.
Wow.
And I was... we're at number 10 and I was like, we're done here. This is fucked. It's, you know, it takes a piece both financially and all that. And then it was Liv. Liv's like, because we're going to go to South America and just have a blowout. I'd let my physical training go. I was drinking too much, taking all the pain meds in the world, all the antipsychotics and that as well. Popping them like the Skittles. Started to get fat, unhealthy, and then that drove. You know, you look in the mirror and you're like, disgusting. Anyway,
so self-loathing sort of stuff. Yeah.
It happens, right? When you've lost what was your purpose. And then Liv was like, hey, there's one in the fridge. Like, it's in a, there's an embryo in the fridge and we didn't think any had survived. And we're like, so? Like, we're done. No, we're not doing it. Just put it in there anyway and hope for the best, see what happens. It took.
No way.
Right, so we ended up cancelling South America and Harry came along, my son.
Yeah.
So he was born 6 weeks early, wasn't in a good way. We got through that part. And then, again, I was like, it's still dosed up, you know, like operating about 55% in a bit of a haze most of the time, partying, drinking, like just going a bit rogue. And then there we had this one day where it was just Harry and I at home, and he was about 6 months old, something like that. And he wakes up from his nap. He must have had a nightmare. I was like, he's just going crazy. You know that scream that kids make where you're like, oh, Jesus.
I don't have kids, but I've got a mate who's got a kid, and their scream for a five-month-year-old is just...
Mate, there's a...
I was like, where does that come from?
There's a scream of difficulty. There's a scream for discomfort. And then there's get the fuck in here, Dad, before I lose my mind scream. All right? And I walk in and I go to turn the light on. And as I twist, my back just goes... Gosh, and I just went bang. Wow. And I hit the deck and I just couldn't get my legs to do what they're supposed to do, nothing. And I was like, okay, well, shit, he's at the cot screaming at me. And I can't let this happen. So I'm like, crawl across the floor, grab up onto the side of the cot, pull it down. I like try to reach over. It's fucking killing me. My eyes are swinging. Roll him up the side of the cot and then just drop down. Had him sitting on my chest. And he's like, that's better. And I was like, I can't move properly. And we just had to lay there for however long until I started to get my faculties back on and things started moving again. And then, you know, off we go. And we started going there. I was like, all right, get the fuck back in the gym, start doing your X-Fizz, physios, start doing all the things that you're supposed to be doing right now. Lay off the booze for a little bit. Maybe let's start thinking about getting off the meds, because right now, Harry, when he learnt to crawl, felt nothing. And I was like, we got to start tapering off this shit, because you're not going to be a good dad.
Mm.
And once I'd made the switch between infantry officer as an identity to dad, once I made that switch, everything else, I was able to layer off those decisions and their values based around being a dad. So I don't miss physio appointments. I don't miss ex-phys. I don't miss any. I actually went into Pilates for like 2 years.
Yeah, I did try that.
Reformer Pilates?
Yeah, yeah, I did that.
Jesus Christ. Like, props to anyone out there
it's
doing
tough.
Reformer Pilates.
So it's like finding external, not motivators, but external reasons to get through those tough decisions.
Oh, no, mine was all fear-based. It was
fear-based,
all internal fear.
Internal fear.
Based. It's like, you are going to be a shit dad if you don't get your physical self in order.
I can really relate to that because I procrastinated about looking after my mental health. Even getting out of the army, but even playing footy and dealing with a lot of anxiety and not be able to regulate my emotions. And through my whole 20s, I would find coping mechanisms to hide those emotions or just trying to like, so drugs and alcohol, big one, partying.
Huge.
I was just like, nah, this is, it's for me, it was too hard diving deep into why I'm feeling like this. It was so much easier having a remedy of go party. And all my 20s, I reckon I got to 29, 30 when I met Jordan and I was still really, really reactive. Zero patience, anything would set me off. Angry for 2 or 3 days. And I remember Jordan sitting me down and I yelled at her for something that was pathetic, really, really pathetic, and really upset her. And then two days later, she sat me down and she said that I'm here with you if you choose to fix this. But if you're not, I don't want my kids to, or our potential kids to ever go through you like that to me. And I was like, fuck, like, I'm going to lose her if I don't do this. So then that was like a big thing for me. It was like, all right, let's fuck this. I've procrastinated for 10, 15 years of not finding answers and not searching and not just like going deep into why I am the way that I am. And that was like a huge motivator for me. And kind of like the fear of like, she's, in my eyes, she's perfect. Am I going to throw that away because I'm too scared to go deep?
The fear of losing her is stronger than the fear of doing the thing that you need to do.
100%.
People, especially in today's society, I know we're not going that way, I suppose, in a podcast, but so positively focused. It's like positive reinforcement, positive reward, 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 reward. You know, dopamine, social media, drugs. It's like there's nothing pushing. It's like you want to play in motivation 90% of the time. You want it to be positively driven. You want it to be dopaminergically moderated. Like that, you want to play in that space. It feels good. But when motivation gives up, you need something that's going to kick your ass. You need something that's like, I do not want to get out of bed today. I really don't. This sucks. I don't want to do anything. My back hurts. My knees hurt. And then it's like, get the fuck up, out of bed, and walk. Because otherwise, you're going to let them down. Otherwise, you're going to let your mates down. Otherwise, you're going to let these people down. You need that.
You do.
And I think this a gearing towards a solely positive reinforcement thing, you can't reward a behavior if it doesn't exist. All right. So once you're moving again, oh, yeah, cool, all right. Ooh, got to the gym, started training. It's like, good, you did the right thing. You are now physically able, more able to play with your kids. All right, reward. Your dad box tick. All right, but when you were thinking about giving up, what message does that send to your kids? And in our case as well, especially in the veteran community, what message does that send to other veterans? That it's okay just to just kick back and do nothing and let everything fall apart. It's like, it's not. It's not okay, especially as a dude, right? You got your responsibilities, you know, your family, your Jordan. It's like, well, you have to do the thing that you said you were going to do.
You got to have that integrity, I think. Though, yeah.
And I think it sounds like I'm being really like psychopathic, but I'm not. So you got to have a fear there so that when the positive feelings and the dopamine and all that gives up, this thing, it's not pretty. It's not the slick solution. It just moves you forward. It keeps it going to the point that you can reset the motivation, then the motivation takes over.
I love that because I've had a chat to some people about motivation versus discipline, and it's sort of like motivation versus fear, really.
because you're not always going to be motivated. You're not always going to feel like to get out of bed or to do this hard thing. But in my head, I don't rely on motivation because it's more like a feeling like you're not always going to be happy or you're not always going to be sad. You're not always going to feel motivated. So I think Jordan said something like, you know, yeah, you can have a day off. And I'm like, can you? Yeah. It's like, I don't always enjoy going to the gym. I don't always enjoy it, but it's like I have a responsibility to go do it.
Yep.
The fear is something that we've obviously talked a little bit about, but the fear of failure, it's something that's really haunted me throughout my life, especially playing footy. I've mentioned in different episodes, it stopped me from trying new things because I was afraid of looking like a fool. And when you try something new, you're always going to look like an idiot. It stopped me from wanting more from my life. And there's this really good quote that I heard that you might be familiar with. It's fear is a mile wide and an inch deep. So it looks like this big ocean that you're going to step into and drown. But when you take the step, you realize it's only that deep and you're not going to drown. And it's such a good visual because for me, it's like all that anxiety about making a tough decision and fearing what the outcome could be. If you just take that step, you realize you're not going to die. You're not going to drown. You can walk through this fear and there's plenty more, I guess, steps you can take. How can people overcome the fear of making a wrong decision and, I guess, embrace the opportunities of learning something new?
I think fear is a constant. All right. And I think there's a difference between fear of doing something and then the fear of the fear of doing something.
Yes.
I think that's the critical distinction. And I'll lean on what I'm trying to do with my son at the moment. All right. And it's it works because it was something that my dad told me. All right. So my son's afraid of the dark sometimes, not to the degree that I was afraid. I was really, really petrified of the dark. And my dad turned around to me once and he goes, because it was bad. It was really bad. And he goes, son, you do know that the things you are scared about that you can't see probably can't see you either. Well, that's something. Right? So multiple iterations, going to the military, working at night a lot, you know, doing all that. And now I've got my son here and he's afraid of the dark. And I was like, there's more. There's more than just they can't see you because, you know, as you know, if you spend a long time in the dark, you get accustomed to the dark, right? So then you can see in the dark. It's one thing I've told my son. It's like, just take some time with it. Let your eyes adjust. Things won't be as scary. You can't be brave unless you're scared. It's a precondition to being brave. Like people that are fearless, it's like don't have the opportunity to be brave because they're not scared.
Yes.
All right. So if fear is a constant, then at multiple iterations throughout your life, you can use that fear to become brave. Now, here's it from a not the psychology, but almost chemical level, is that if you willingly step forward into the fear, you retain your ability to think. It's like stepping into an ice bath. You're willingly stepping into an ice bath. You're like, okay, all right, you can still think, you can still do whatever. If someone walks up to you while you're not looking, picks you up and dumps you in an ice bath, done. Fight, flight, freeze, done. You lose prefrontal cortex, no analysis, no decision-making, problem-solving, all that, and you go into gasp and you're done. That's the same with any fear that we've got. If you willingly step forward into it, right, you retain your faculties and ability to think. You challenge yourself. You actually switch systems from a fear and anxiety system, which is moderated by adrenal cortisol, to a seeking and approach system. You want to go into detail about that. There's this dude by the name of Yak Pangset, right? Effective neurology, absolute weapon. Don't listen to him on YouTube, you'll fall asleep. Right, you read the books, it's good to okay. go. And once you understand that and you go, especially for like my son, which is really important because I don't want him to go through the same level of fear of the dark that I was, because it was debilitating because I just didn't know what to do with it. You know, it didn't matter where it was, it would just shut me down until dad said those things. And I was like, all right. And then when you go in the military, you have to work at night. So it's different. So now to Harry, I just get him into it going, well, what do we know about being afraid, mate? And he goes, well, I can't be brave unless I'm scared. I was like, we can't be brave unless we're scared, mate. So let's look at opportunities to be scared. So, you know, we went out the other day at the back of my house. There's a park and some of our stormwater stuff goes out there and it's raining. Like it's pumping down. And but we've got to clear the stormwater so that the water gets out and flood the house. And I just go, and he goes, are you going out there? I was like, mate, we're not afraid of the rain. And he goes, what? I was like, well, we might be afraid of the rain, but what do we do if we're afraid of the rain? And he goes, well, we get to be brave. It's like, we get to keep brave. So my wife goes and gets him a raincoat, get my old entrenching tool, both get entrenching tools, and off we trot into the park to cut away a little storm.
I love that. Thing.
And so we're out there just digging like morons, like covered in mud and whatever, but it was a great learning experience. So now I think that is the mechanism. Like, there's not going to be any less fear in the world if, I mean, with complexity, with the rate of technological change and all that, there is going to be more uncertainty. AI, there's going to be more uncertainty. So what's your alternative? If you step back from fear, it reinforces the idea that stepping back from fear was a good idea because you're still alive, all right? And you go, okay, and then self-licking ice cream or Pygmalion effect, insert psychological tool here, it reinforces that stepping away from fear was good. But in your gut, you know it wasn't the right decision. So that's where we start anchoring into our value sets and having moral injuries, and it's like, I should have done this, I should have done that.
That regret thing, right? Yeah.
And that has more of an impact than stepping forward into a fear and failing.
And actually doing it, yeah.
All right, so I think if I can, without, to not be a hypocrite, I have to exhibit the same behavior in front of my son that I'm trying to get him to do. And I want my daughter, my two-year-old daughter, to be exactly the same too. But she's a bruiser. She's like, throw me up in the air. It's like, okay, all right.
Well, what scares you? What are you scared of?
Not being physically able to protect my kids.
Oh, okay.
Yep. That is one of my biggest fears and drives a lot of like the rehab and a lot of the behavior, like letting my people down.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there was a point there where I couldn't lift things. I couldn't, you know, come from in the military in a combat sense, like your job was physical protection, right? So when my body was starting to fall apart, I'd stand up there and I'd be briefing, my legs would start shaking. I never had a problem speaking in public before, and then everything would start shaking. I was like, oh my God, you're now not competent. You now can't physically protect those people that your duty to protect. Like, you can't do that. And then translate that to my kids. And then there's this, if you can't protect your kids, like, what are you doing here, mate? So, you know, when I ripped the pec tendon off, I had one arm, I was like, fuck, what can we do here? And you run this risk if you lean too far into that fear of not being able to protect them. What you end up doing is closing them off. You put barricades in place, you lock all doors all the time, you don't go outside, you don't take them into experiences that they should be getting as kids. You're not going out in public, you're not doing all that. And then it's like, neck up, John. Yeah. Like, get them out there. You can physically protect your kids. And then you have to sort of fight the imposter syndrome, fight the fear, and do all of that so that you can get the experiences which validate the fact that you can do those things.
I had one of my best mates sat on that seat last year, and he was a combat engineer.
Yep. So much respect for combat engineers.
Yeah, I should put you in contact with him because he's an absolute legend.
And weapons.
And he spoke about a day that was a turning point for him. He was out on operations and they were clearing a hillside, and one of his teammates stood an IED, lost his legs, saved his life. But that night, his commanders were saying, all right, the next day we're going back out there to that same spot. We need to clear this hillside. And he was saying that him and his teammates got no sleep. They're all fucking so nervous. They were so scared. Like, they'd just seen what just happened that day. And he said on the way out there the next day, the next morning, he was just like, all right, how do I do my job? How do I be calm and do my job? So on the way out there, in his head, he was saying, you're going to die, you're going to die, you're going to die. Okay, accept it. And that helped him clear his head for him to do his job because he was just so fucking scared and nervous. Were there times in your deployment that you had to confront and overcome fear?
My fears on deployment were always geared around letting
people down.
Team down.
Yeah.
Always geared towards letting him down. I didn't have a lot of firefights.
Yeah.
All of them, my biggest threats were internal from Afghan National Army people and IEDs. One of those things I can't do anything about. Right? The IEDs. So my combat engineers, you know, where I'm like, I have so much respect for those guys. I mean, they're funny.
He's hilarious.
Mate, they would come around and they were minesweepers and they'd be like, oh, careful. Also, they'd like throw metal on the ground near me. I was like, You take care. You take care. They're the
cheeky
best.
Little fuck.
So good, man. And that dark humor, right? It's that dark humor.
It's the dark humor that
pulls a lot of the fear and uncertainty area.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you just go, you guys focus on this stuff, and I'll focus on this stuff, and work together and go, oh, outrageously competent. Competent. They'll find anything, mate. They just, so I never had, I didn't, I was like, I can't control that.
Mm.
They are amazing at what they do. They're literally the best. It's like, okay, all right, so I'll focus on what I can control. But the fear was always letting them down.
Was that, yours?
Always. It's like, what am I doing right now? And let them down. And, you know, to the point where you're like, am I the right person for this?
Mm.
You know, and there's better officers out there. There always are. But I also cared about them enough to have that fear.
Mm.
You know, there's probably people out there that wouldn't care about letting people down. I've never met them, but I'm sure they're out there.
You talked about before that you got to be scared to be brave.
Mm-hmm.
If you're happy to, can you tell me a story or something that you witnessed over in your deployment that was an immense act of bravery or courage?
I'll tell you about because I wasn't out on that last, patrol. Something that has always struck me almost like a superhuman act of strength in, you know, just one of those situations. And I remember seeing a video when my guys came back from that patrol, and I was livid about not being out there, but I can't exactly regret it because they all came home.
Yeah.
All right. So I remember watching this video, and one of the soldiers, so they got ambushed from three sides, of Afghan vehicle got torn apart, and I'm watching this video, and you see one of the guys grabs an 84, so rocket launcher, big one, heavy, right, and he runs up this hill. It's like this. All right, he just runs up, and so the guys are getting hit from three sides, races up on top of this hill and just goes, fuck, I don't know how he did, because I've carried those things. They're heavy, yeah, and you're puffed, and you'd be like, oh, doing these ones. Just straight up there, prop stops, bang, puts this, I don't know where it ended up hitting, but the report afterwards, you know, straight through the stronghold that the Taliban are firing off, just neutralizes it, and then they ended up getting mortared by Afghans because Afghans direct laid mortars straight onto my brick, and I'm sitting here watching this video, like, and I know they're all back in, like they're all back home already. They're already back in this thing.
So you know they're all.
I know they're okay. I'm like,
but still,
run!
Yeah.
And he just boom, straight back on the shoulder, runs back down like it's not a thing. The age of, you know, Afghanistan, Iraq, and all that. Just the things that these people were capable of in that moment. I hold all soldiers that have deployed and been in those situations just with so much respect of what they were able to achieve, what they're able to do. Like we're living in an age of superhuman strength and courage and determination. And again, a lot of it was driven by not wanting to let their mates down. Mm. You read some of the VC titles, medals of gallantry and all that, and you go,
this can't be real.
The fear of letting my mates down.
Yeah.
And you go, that was enough to do whatever the fuck that was.
Yeah. When you finished your military career, you know, it was a lot of physical stuff that you're dealing with, not too much sort of mentally, I guess, finding a, you know, purpose and that sort of thing. How do you think your military career affected your wife?
Well, she had to deal with the fallout. Right, so there was, and you know, you sit there from an expectation perspective. My wife signed up to a marriage with someone who was physically fit, competent, strong, and all of that, and then watched the resilience drop, the physical strength drop, watch it all drop.
Mm.
And it's like, you signed up to something that's not all it's cracked up to be at this point in time.
Mm, yeah.
You know, it's not the husband thing that I married. So, you know, she's strong. She's tough. She's an emergency nurse. She was an ex-army nursing officer as well.
Oh, right.
Like, she gets it.
Yeah.
Like, she gets it. Yeah. And she stayed through it. Kicked me in the ass when I probably needed it, but then was supportive and empathetic in some of those times where potentially she couldn't help. That would have been hard to deal with, knowing that your significant other is going through some things that you just can't help with. Mm. I'm very strong-willed, determined, stubborn person. So if I don't want help, I'm not going to take it. And that would have been hard. Mm. But she's still here, you know, and she's an amazing mother to our two kids. You want to talk about demonstrating to children what empathy looks like and how they should understand what an empathetic relationship with. That's my wife and my kids. They're like, You know, they think, and they know that the sun shines wherever she will. She's seen, mate. They can run it up to her. And she gives them all of that love, support, empathy, and it's almost like a maternal side of the house. And, you know, she's still here. And she went through that whole journey, you know. And she's got her own demons from her time. You know, they weren't, as a nursing officer, she didn't have the best run in comparison. Probably the best career path that could possibly have in my turn, except for the ending. She didn't have a good time. She deployed to Nauru. She had some things happen and all that. So she had a pretty rough trot through that. And that, you know, then with the 11 rounds of IVF. And all, so yeah, she's tough. Yeah. She was resilient. She was able to, you know, I suppose, support me through that journey back without going, no, this is too much for me. So she stayed in it. It was tough for her, I'd imagine.
Yeah. You just mentioned resilience, and that's something that I love to chat to my guests about, and something that I'm really interested in, because I've had this perception that you need to experience some sort of hardship or suffering to be resilient. But is it more of a choice or a decision you make rather than an outcome? Like, you view your hardship, you view what you've gone through, your suffering, as a gift, and that makes you resilient. I'm really interested to know your thoughts around building resilience in kids, because you know, I'm not a parent, you're a dad. I never want my kids to go through any pain or suffering.
Right, I get it.
But I would love my kids to be resilient.
Yeah.
Can you be resilient without going through hardship?
I think you can understand resilience without going through hardship. But in order to know you are resilient, you have to have experienced some sort of pain and suffering.
Okay.
I mean, but the difference is, can you find meaning in that suffering? Does the suffering have purpose?
Yes.
All right. So it's like your kids fall over, right? And they hurt themselves, and you're like, just want to do it. And then you're like, hang on a second. What if by me being too much in, I set them up for more pain later when they can't deal with their own problems?
Yes.
So, you know, like, my daughter falls over, she hurts herself, and all you want to do is pick her up. Like, angelic, blonde hair, blue eyes. Like, she's like this. And you're like, what do we do when we fall over and we hurt ourselves? She goes, ice. I'm like, ice. So she'll walk to the freezer now and she'll put it. And all you want to do is pick her up and just go, it's going to be all right. And just want to be sitting there, and you're like,
probably how we were, how I was bloody parented. Like, they were always picking us up.
And you go, all right, and same with my son.
Yeah.
It's like there's a point where you need them to know that they're supported.
Mm.
All right. And then, but you also need them to be self-sufficient. So I see it happens. And mate, we talk about this in coaching. We talk about it in teams. And it's, you have to do things in parallel. One is, you provide a safe-ish environment, right, that is safe to fail, safe to experience without dying. All right, I think that's the caveat, right? Mm. Mission failure, kids die, mission fail, right? The other one, and it has to happen at the same time, is you need to build strength. Now, half of that is trying to teach them how to think, not what to think, right? And the other one is how to navigate the world. So experience risk, do dangerous things within a safe construct, all right? I mean, that's
a fine line, isn't it?
Mate, I'll sit there and my son will be like standing on a wall and he'll be doing, and I'll be like, if he falls on a meter,
you're assessing what could happen. Cool. Yeah, yeah.
But if you try and do one or the other, you cook them. So it's like, no safety construct. I'm just going to help build strength. They will fail. They will hurt themselves in a big way. Whereas if you try and just provide a box of safety around them, they're never going to learn to be strong. So they might be safe at home, but as soon as they're out of the house, well, the context's different. The safety guidelines are different. Everything changes.
Especially when they get older and realize the parents aren't going to get them out of trouble.
Right. I mean, as we've all learned. So I think that part in developing resilience in kids is about providing a safe framework for them to learn. I mean, I've got a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old. I don't know, question whether I've got this right or not. I've got no idea, mate. You know, time will tell.
Yeah.
And then the other side is, you know, how do you build them strength? And first one for me with Harry is trying to get him to think, like, how to think, not what. Don't take my ideas, don't take my beliefs for granted. Like, find your own path. How do you, so if we have a problem, how would you do it? You know, open questions, try and prompt the response so that he's starting to think about problems when I'm not there.
And you have that open dialogue with him early.
One of my other biggest fears about not being able to physically, and it probably comes back to the physical protection, is that someone can come into my house and influence my kid without going through me.
Yeah,
social media and that sort of thing. So Harry doesn't, you know, he's five. So that's not a thing. But I want him to be able to think and make decisions when I'm not there, because he's going to have to.
Mm.
Right? He's not going to be running every social media message or whatever through me when he gets them, when he's older.
Especially at school. I mean, like, you got different adults, not raising them, but sort of having that influence. You got kids at school having that influence too.
That scares me, the fact that someone can come into my house and talk to my kids without coming into my house.
Mm. Yeah.
And I work in, I won't go into the actual program that we're running because it's not for public consumption yet, but we work in prisons. Mm. I see some of the more nefarious characters that are out there. I know what's out there. Mm. And I know the pathways and the mechanisms that they use to access kids. And you go, that scares me. The fact that someone can influence my kid without having to go through me, that is some fear-inducing stuff. And so that's what prompts you to go, okay, I want to tell my son the answer to this. I've got the answer right here. But it's like, how to think. It's just...
We have a culture at the moment
that's
fun, fast and easy.
Fun, fast and easy.
A culture of people that don't do discomfort. Mm-hmm. I've seen friends, people give up on jobs or they quit jobs when they find out it's too hard or the hour's too long. I've seen people, including myself, give up on dreams and goals because I guess the journey seems too difficult or too long. Only realizing later in life that I've seen the most amount of growth is when I throw myself into the deep end and put myself in situations where I feel most comfortable is when I see the most amount of growth. This is just an assumption, and I remember getting told in the army that the assumption's the mother of all fuck ups. but my assumption from you is you seem like someone who thrives in discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
How do you teach people to embrace discomfort?
I don't know about thrive in discomfort, but I've come to accept this idea of being comfortable with discomfort.
Yeah, okay.
Right, because the alternative is much more scary. Mm. Right, in my case, with training and all that, the alternative to getting yourself back to being physically in order is way more scary, because that means you can't pick up your kids. Mm. Right, you can't play with them. You can't do any of that. You can't be a dad. So the fear again, it sounds like I'm psychopathic. I'm not. I just found that that's the way to navigate this idea of discomfort, and that you can't have any growth without challenge. It doesn't exist, all right? And we're in a society, we're in a culture now where pleasure, dopamine, comfort is so easy to attain that it's the default. Mm. The default isn't challenge. The default is comfort, right? And let's be honest, that's what your internal dialogue is telling you to do. I mean, your brain is geared towards a negative bias. Evolutionary, getting chased by saber-toothed tigers and all that. It's like, oh, well, we've got to avoid threat.
You've got to keep you safe at all costs, and that's comfort zone. Yeah,
keep you safe.
Safe, yeah.
Right? It's not growth. No. It's not challenged. Mm. It's not successful. It's not high performance. It's safe.
Mm.
Now, safety is not only geared towards a physical sense, it's a social one as well. Mm. It's like, I'm not going to go out and get COVID. You're going to see the impacts of being locked down for years to come here. It's like going out and meeting people is not comfortable.
Mm. It's not safe. It builds like that anxiety around going out and like...
Judgment.
Judgment. Yeah, exactly.
And then it leans back into uncertainty, which is one of the biggest fears that we as humans have. And you go, well, what's the alternative? I can't control what everyone else does. I can control what I do. I can, to a degree, influence what my kids and people in the immediate circle do. But that's about it. Mm. Right, our circles are pretty small of control. I think focusing on what you can actually control versus what is out there that you can have issues with is half the battle. So back to, I suppose, the question is, you can't have growth without challenge. It's like muscles, right? They don't grow unless they're torn, all right? And in order to do that, you have to seek out and accept discomfort. Like, that's just what you have to do. Now, your levels of discomfort that you're prepared to accept are different.
Mm.
But I think as well, it's balanced by having this idea of, if I don't, then what?
Then what?
Then what? I mean,
I love that.
In my case, I'm pretty, not lucky, but I have kids that look at me. They watch what I do and they take in everything.
Mm.
All right. And this is subjective to me. I don't care what other people do with their lives, but subjective to me. If Harry doesn't see me coming back in sweating from training, if he doesn't see me reading ridiculous books that I don't want to read, right? Affective Neurology by Yuck Bainsap. Are you kidding? The guy wrote it in like type 4 font. It's like 7 textbooks in one. It's the worst, yeah. Right? But if he doesn't see me reading, developing, he doesn't see me how I treat my wife, if he doesn't, you know, if he sees any of that, he's going to absorb that.
Yeah.
I think that's the right thing to do.
Because I read something that kids, more often than not, they will copy not what you say.
Correct.
They will copy your actions.
Yep.
And I look at my own father, mm-hmm. and I'm like, fuck, I am some of my habits is because I've watched my dad's habits.
Yeah.
And my mum was like, yeah, you don't really listen to what your dad says. You listen to what he does.
Yep. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
It's funny. I had a lot of anger issues as a kid. Like, you know, you just like, and it's, yeah, you got pretty bad, you got pretty destructive. And every now and again, I see a glimpse of it in Harry.
Yeah.
I'm very disciplined around Harry and my behaviors and my language. Mm. But I see some of the way he acts and I'm like, where did I show him that? Because that's me. Yeah. Like what he's doing is me.
Yeah, yeah.
And I go, I'm racking my brain back to where, has he ever seen me? If I get caught off in a car and I'm like, I'm trying to rack my brains on where he's seen it. Mm. I don't know where he's seen it. But I'm like, that is me.
Mm.
I'm like, okay, what have I learned now that can help him deal with that, right? To get himself back under control, you know, thinking, you know, start asking questions, you know, take some time to yourself, like trying to go through all of these things. I've read so many parenting books.
And I bet you have.
I was like, I don't know the right way for anything, but all you can do is what you can with what you got, right?
So moving past the military life,
yeah,
8th Mile Consulting. Yep. What is it and what do you do?
Mate, 8th Mile's been this evolving beast. It's fun.
Is it?
I'll be honest, mate. Yeah. It's fun. It's hard sometimes. Like it's challenging. I'm a bit luckier in the sense that my best mate and I started it.
Mm.
Now, a lot of people turn around and say, never get into business with your family, your friends. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like, okay, depending on your friend.
Mm.
Like Dave and I, 20 years, it's, there's no gaps, there's no secrets, there's no walls. We've just brought in Evan, who's another director, again, 20 years of friendship. You know, we've got a close group of us, really tight. We know everything about us, but Hannah, Deb, they're absolute weapons. I'll be honest, 8th Mile started as a mechanism for us to focus on our rehab. It was like, you know, we didn't want a gap in employment, but we also knew we need to get our shit together.
Mm.
And then we started doing things. And it started as like a purist, I'm going to insert some consulting wank words in here. It started as like strategy development, project management, change management, you know, all of that. And then it sort of evolved because we would go and do projects and get drawn into by leaders. Leaders pull us into side rooms. We're like, oh, this problem with our team.
Mm.
You know, we've got, this is happening. We're starting to see gossip. We're starting to say, what do you reckon? So we'd have leaders pulling us in, trying to ask those questions. I think they saw ex-military officers, operational deployments, they saw that and they're like, well, maybe they might have an insight. And then COVID hits. Right? And so we have to double down and we build an online personal development leadership course. And so in the process of building that, I'm like, we know this stuff and we've done it and we've got some experiences in it. Maybe we could provide just some level of insight into some situations people might not know of, and we approach it from a position of mistakes. This is where we've categorically shanked it. So if, and with the benefit of hindsight and experience, you know, if I had another shot at it, would I do it differently? I'd do it differently this way. Add some theoretical knowledge over the top and off we go. And it got legs.
Mm.
Like it got moving. Like there's something in this. So now we double down on the personal development and leadership side and we're starting to see this just, we just opened out. So we set up in Caloundra, that was first office. We've just opened our Brisbane office and that's where Evan sort of runs his side of the house, mates. Mm. Well, everyone's running towards this clinical, white, painted, you know, almost sterile environment. Ours is all live edge tables, you know, Chesterfields and all that. So we effectively built the place that we want to work out of and we're now geared solely pretty much towards that leadership.
Did you ever think, like, when you finished the military, that your skills and everything you learnt could switch over to the business and self-development world? Was there ever a thought that that could happen?
I thought it was the biggest cliche in the world.
Oh, did you?
So going into leadership, personal development stuff, I was like, you wanker.
Yeah.
Like, of course, ex-military, you're gonna go, it's like, but.
The old Jocko Wilker.
Yeah, but when you see the impact on people and the, you know, we've helped people through cancer, we've helped We used to work in an organisation called Trojans Trek, which was deals with the far spectrum of post-traumatic stress, major depressive disorder, and that. And when you see that with a little bit of perspective, and you can actually have an impact, you're like, okay, so this isn't noise. Mm. This isn't wank. Like, there's something in this. Getting out of the project management, that side of the house, is probably the best way that we're able to move forward.
Mm.
And actually seeing that you have an impact, that's something. And again, coming from a position of mistakes, it's like, well, there's no moral high ground here. Mm. Like, we've just shanked it probably more than most, and we're notoriously lucky, right? But with the benefit of hindsight,
we can help.
We can help. Yeah, just don't do this, and you're going to be 1 or 2% better off.
I wrote something down for you. Something that I really struggle with today is feeling proud of myself for the things that I've achieved, and also feeling confident that I can achieve them despite the success I've had.
Mm-hmm.
During my time playing rugby for 22 years, not one game did I run out with the belief that I was good enough to be out there, all the confident in my ability. Despite the teams that I made and the level that I reached, all I was thinking was, please don't fuck up. Don't make a mistake. It has become a common theme where I doubt my ability in so many areas of my life and I second-guess myself. And I'm honestly surprised at people's reactions to the podcast sometimes. Mm-hmm. Have you ever experienced anything like this?
Yep.
You have?
Yeah, 100%. So imposter syndrome is huge.
Mm.
We built a whole course based on it, and it was based on my experiences in the last 2 years in the military.
Wow.
So so the last 2 years is when the body really started to fall apart, and I hadn't had too many issues confidence-wise. It was a little bit of imposter syndrome, like, should I be here leading? Like, when I took the guys overseas, like, they have weapons. Mm-hmm. Some of the best soldiers that you ever work with. And I was like, well, should I be the one in command here? Maybe. Like, they're amazing. So never a bad word about those guys. But in that last 2 years, you stand there and you have your infantry beret and uniform, and people expect a level of physical ability from an infantryman. You should be able to do your 50K pack marches with your 50 kilos on. You should be able to should be able to carry another man in full kit on your shoulders and run. And as my body was falling apart, it's like, you're not...
Can't do any of that.
You can't do that. Yeah. Like, you're not that guy. You're not an infantryman. And you're standing here briefing, or you're doing your operational briefs, or you're talking to generals, and they're looking at you like you're an infantryman. And you're sitting, I'm half, quarter of an infantryman at this stage. And you go... Well, so what? What do you do? And there's a lot of chat out there about positive reinforcement and thinking better of yourself and all. But imposter syndrome is a constant fight. It is just a fight, right? And sometimes you need a shot of objectivity. I'll give you an example. I stood up to give an operations brief once, and it was in front of insert high ranking officers, peers, everyone. And usually, mate, back in the day, the briefs, no issues. And I stood there on a subject that I know, like operations that we're currently running, subject that I know, and I felt my legs shaking, I felt my hands shaking, so I like ditched the notepad, and I just felt my face flushing, and I thought my voice was shaking, and I'm like, oh, I am not delivering any amount of confidence in this plan or that I know what I'm doing. And I just stayed there. I was just like, just grind this thing out, like just fight this thing out. And when I finished, I walked up to Dave, because Dave was in there as well. I was like, man, tell me what I need to hear, not what I want to hear. This is what I felt. This is what I thought was happening. He goes, mate, I didn't see any of it.
Oh, wow.
And he was honest. Like, if he was going to...
He doesn't bullshit.
No way. He'd be like, mate, saw your legs shaking, saw this. And he goes, didn't see any of it. I was like, well, that's interesting.
Mm.
Well, at least I can hold myself with that layer or that level of issues. Right, well, that's something. That's not nothing. So a shot of objectivity to go, well, you're like, I'm no good at this, I'm no good at this, I'm no good at this, I'm rubbish, don't make a mistake. All it takes is for someone to come across from a flank and be like, I know you think you're shit. You're not as shit as you think. Mm. Let me tell you why. Bang, bang, bang. What you are is rubbish at this and this and this, and we can work on that. But the stuff that you're seeing, it's like looking in a mirror. Right, you look in a mirror, that's not an accurate reflection. That's not how people see you. You want to see how people see you, look in a video.
Mm.
It's weird because it's like, it's back to front, back to right? Front, but we always look at ourselves in a mirror.
Yeah.
How you see yourself is not reflective of how other people see you. Right? Yeah. And if you can work on yourself to a point where you're achieving what you value, so what your values are, there's something in that. There is something tough, there's something strong, and there's something worth rewarding in that. So if one of your values is something like integrity, which would be do what you promise, and you're doing the things you said you were going to do, well, there's nobility in that. There's courage in that, because it's hard. It's hard to do the things that you said you were going to do, right? And that's worth rewarding. And then you go, well, I'm doing that. That's not nothing. Small wins, really small wins to aggregate over time.
Love that.
Mm, something different.
Yeah. one of your, I guess, your programs on Eighth Mile is Reinvent Yourself.
Yep.
And I saw a really, really good quote that I want you to get your thoughts on is, burn your ships, not your bridges.
Yeah, yeah. So Cortez. Yeah. There's a guy who went over to find New Mexico, and what he did is when he landed, in order to stop or in order to galvanize his group to move forward in a direction and not think about going home, what he did is he scuttled his boats, right? So he took everything usable, and this is the key part, right? He took everything usable off the ships and then scuttled them. So all the good things that have come from the journey,
yeah,
he took. It's like, these are going to be useful moving forward. But anything that wasn't useful, he scuttled, yeah, right? So you burn the ships, but the bridges are your networks, yeah, are your people, are the good things that have transcended through that journey. Because the temptation is we would throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's like, oh, well, you know, that was a really shit experience, and I failed this, and I fucked this up. And it's like, well, hang on. The lessons learned from that, you've got to bring forward. The people you met, the relationships, you've got to bring those forward. Right? You can't just go, at this point, I sucked, I was terrible. You've got to bring the positives through, even if it's just the lessons learned. Mm. So how you burn the bridges burn the boats so that you make the decision, you commit to it moving forward.
You've got no other option.
Yeah, but don't drop all the good things that you've learned. Yeah, don't drop the usable stuff. You've got to bring that stuff forward. Mm. So that's where that comes from.
I love that. We've got four quickfire questions.
Yeah, send it.
To finish off, what are your non-negotiables for living a healthy and full life?
Set the goal, be committed to the outcome. For me, it's physical health, because it completely revolves around being a committed father. So set the example and demonstrate the behaviour. Mm. That would be a non-negotiable. If you're going to do the thing you said you were going to do.
I think we've touched on it a little bit here, but when you're on the edge of quitting and you're ready to give up, what do you say to yourself?
What's it going to feel like when you give up? Right. So if you don't do that session, or you don't step up and speak in front of that crowd, what are you going to feel like? And then visualize that disappointment, and that'll give you the adrenaline cortisol kick to get the fuck up and move and do it.
If you could go back to a time in your life, where would you go and why?
That's a really, really good question, because I'm not a big one for going back. I would love to go back and re-feel the birth of my two kids.
Nice.
That was, there was a moment when Harry was born, and it was a little bit catastrophic. He had, my wife, when she listens, she's going to lose her mind. She had a burst lump. All right, so he was not, she'll be like, it's a pneumothorax or whatever. Yeah. Right, and she'll be like, you butchered that. But he had a burst lung, and he was not happy. And so he got brought out, and they raced him straight out the back. And I was like, oh, that's not a good sign. And they're like, John, come out the back. And I was like, all right. Came out the back, and he was losing his mind, man. He was not happy, and he was not in a good way. And he had his hand open like that. He was like, ah. So I was like, you know, I put my finger in his hand. He stopped screaming, rolls on his side, and then peed all over me. And I was like, oh, boy's marking his territory. Like, I get it. I would love to see those two moments again. And
would you?
When Ellie was born, when Harry was born, because they were just like...
amazing.
I think actually, the moment that I think got me, and I was like, I don't get got very often, right, apart from like watching Marley and Me or something. Mm. Oh. But it would get you like deep and putting down my dog. where he went into a humidity crib, went in special care, like we couldn't touch him, hold him or anything for ages. When they pulled him out for the first time onto my wife, I was like,
fuck,
God damn, fuck. pollen in here, you know, hay fever, like, Jesus. Yeah, people need to wash their hands after cuddling cats. Those moments, they were good. And I think, you know, a lot of people who had good operational experience would probably take a moment back there. Mm. Just a moment.
Yeah, yeah. Not that too much.
Not too much, but just that moment of when you were, you know, surrounded by competence, surrounded by some of the most professional soldiers in the world, just to go, yeah, it was everything I thought it was. Mm. They were those people, and just a moment, and then get back into it.
Your military experience has given you so many positive traits, so many good skill sets, mindsets. Has it given you anything that you wish it hadn't?
I mean, I can't look back with any regret on that time because it's made with, if anything were to change, if you were to change anything back in that service, in that history, in the decisions you've made to then, it would probably end up in not being where you are today.
Yeah, that ripple effect.
Yeah, the butterfly effect.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
If anything were to change back then, I didn't end up with a Harry or an Eleanor. Not worth it.
Yeah.
Not even worth it. Yeah. So any good habits, any bad habits from that time, you take them forward and you do what you can with them.
Love that. Last one. A bit of a tricky one maybe.
Yeah.
30-second or less trick people can practice to increase their mental strength.
Do hard things. Do challenging things. So if you're hungry, delay it even a little bit before you eat. Right? If you want to do something and it's achievable, it's right there, just delay it slightly. Right? Now, there's some science behind it within the anterior mid-cingulate cortex and building willpower and that.
Yeah.
But it is that delay of gratification will put you in the top 10%. Because everybody else isn't doing it. They're not delaying it.
I love that you finished on that because I've got a quote by Dr. Andrew Huberman, who
is the guy.
Is the man. The reason to deliberately do hard things is so that when non-self-elected challenges arrive, and they will, you can tell yourself, I don't know how this is going to turn out, but I know I can do hard things. Doing hard things is always worthwhile.
That one. Because if it's challenging, it has value, right? And not everyone's doing challenging things, right? That's the leadership thing as well. Leadership's hard, and that's why it has value. Difficult conversations are hard, and that's why they have value. Doing it well is even harder, and that's why it's even more valuable, and that's why not everyone can do it.
Love that. Yeah. I've got a closing tradition of the podcast where I don't ask the last question. I get a family friend, a loved one, family member, they send in questions for the guests.
Yeah.
So, your best mate.
I can only imagine.
I don't know what he means by this question. So, your business partner, best friend, Dave Neal, he sent in a question and he goes, tell him to tell us the story about the camel.
We're out teaching Afghan National Army guys how to run a vehicle checkpoint. Right. And we're out in the... Yep, between our patrol base and a place they call the Sphinx feature, which is covered in IEDs. And at this stage, relatively benign, but, you know, the threat picture wasn't great with vehicle-borne IEDs and all that. So we were setting up a vehicle checkpoint. And it was just this ominous feel about everything to do with the day. I mean, I had my snipers in Overwatch up in the patrol base. I got recovered, but it just had this... heart stifling
the gut feeling about it.
It was bad. And then it was at a time where interpreters and that were getting kidnapped and, you know, threatened, and families like they were targeting interpreters, families and things like that. And I had been talking to my interpreter about a lot of stuff. He was the best.
Was he?
The amount of times that guy saved my life.
Really?
Just by his read on a situation. He'd be like, John, take your glasses off now. And I'd be like, okay, take them off, because the Afghans they want to be able to see in your eyes, and, you know, things that I would pick.
From, little stuff like that. Okay.
All the atmospherics and cultural shifts, changes, like, John, you need to take your hand off your pistol. You need to do this, you need to do that. And I'd be like, okay, cool. And those subtle shifts in my
body language and that sort of thing.
So you're being too aggressive, you know, take it back a bit, or be more aggressive, be more deliberate. Like, say, he would give me all those
little cues reads and stuff.
And mate, the amount of issues that
resolved.
Matt, I can't even. Mental. And so in this time where, you know, interpreters getting kidnapped and all that.
By the Taliban?
Yeah. My interpreter disappears while we're on the ground. He walks off, and I was like, oh, shit. Oh, has anyone seen name? I don't know if he's still in country yet, so I won't mention his name. So anyone seen him? Where's he gone? And we do this search, start looking around everywhere for him. I'm starting to freak out. I'm about to call this one in. And then he appears at the front of the vehicle checkpoint with a shepherd and a herd of camels. And I was like, where the hell have you been? And he goes, JC, you're always talking about how funny it would be to ride a camel in Afghanistan. You know, you and your Sikh, the Shannons, you know, yeah. You guys always talking about. And I was like, mate, that was a joke. He's like, didn't get the joke. And I was like, it was a joke. And he goes, well.
The sarcasm didn't land in
didn't
there.
Didn't go fast.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And he goes, well.
Here's your camel.
Camel's here, mate. I was like, oh, no, mate, that's unprofessional. It was like, that's terrible. And my platoon sergeant, Ned, comes like, great dude. This guy, he's, again, I've been blessed with great platoon sergeants, like good man. You know, he looked after me. I got really sick when I was over there and ended up just taking all the briefs for me.
Yeah.
He's a guy that if I was cooked, like having, he'd be like, go to bed.
Yeah.
I'm like, what do you mean? No, you go to bed. Tell me what to do. Like, go to bed. And then he'd rock up and food because I was working like 3 days straight. So he's a good dude. And he goes, get the fucking camel, mate. And I was like, I'm not getting it. And he goes, just get on the camel. We'll take a couple of pictures and then we'll put this thing to bed. So I was like, fuck. So I'm all tooled up, right? I've got all my kit. So I get on this camel. I take these photos and I go to get off the camel. Mordezai yells at the camel. Speaks in Dari or Pashtun, sorry.
Yeah.
Camel stands up. Starts walking through the vehicle checkpoint. So I'm sitting here, tooled up, going,
what the fuck?
I was like, get me off this thing, mate. And snipers, and they're like, are you riding a camel? I was like, no, fuck off. And they go, oh, I can read your name tag this far away, mate. Like, you're riding a camel. I was like, yeah, why are you looking at me and not watching my back? They're like, yeah, out. And I go, mate, you just get me off this thing now.
Yeah.
Otherwise, because if we get brassed up, I'm going to be like,
yeah, you'll be a full Rambo on a camel.
I'm going to be that that wanker officer that rode into a fight on a camel. Yeah. And so, anyway, he sat down, got off the camel, and I was like, we're just going to pretend like this never happened. One of the lads sends me this photo, it was a fair few years later, of a guy in World War One sitting on a camel in front of the Sphinx.
Yeah.
So, you know, with the face blown off.
Face blown.
The feature I'm walking past is a Sphinx feature because it's all been blown up. Yeah. And I was like, good.
So what happens is the interpreter, do they get asylum? Do they
so there's programs and there's avenues at the moment where people are trying to get them over there. It's hard. Really hard.
So what do they get out of it?
So they get paid pretty well.
Oh, do they?
Very well. Yeah, they were getting paid pretty well and they send all their money back to their families.
Yeah.
Whether it's commensurate with the risk that they're under, I mean,
knowing, there's so much risk. Right,
knowing what you know now about Taliban and come back home, that's a tough one.
Yeah.
But man, he was.
They're so essential, aren't they, though?
Oh, yeah.
Apart from getting the camels.
Oh, I've been gone for that amount of time.
Was it a while?
I was long enough for me to be
worried. Thanks very much for coming on today. I've learnt so much from you, and it's been an absolute pleasure getting the chance to meet you and have a chat to you.
Thanks for the invite, mate. It's been a really, really great experience. And I love what you do, mate. This is
appreciate
this
it.
This is important stuff.
Yeah. Thanks very much.
Oh, mate. Cheers.
Cheers, mate.